Good morning. My name's Ed Mutum, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
And I'm glad to be here. I tend to drop my voice sometimes when I talk, so I want you people on the sides, if all of a sudden you don't hear me, would you be so kind to wave at me? I know you won't be waving at me for anything other than raise my voice, I hope. But please feel free to do that. I'm just delighted to be here. For those of you who thought I was a father, I want to tell you, your confessions last night with me are safe. And I've just had a ball. Ron has been an absolute delight. Mike, Cheryl, everybody that I've run into, it's really been a blessing. Just had a wonderful, wonderful time. And I really am delighted to be here, get the little basket, a lovely room, and a chance to meet a lot of new people, because people ask me why I still go and talk, and it says it's very simple. You watch lives change before your very eyes. And, the talks with Beverly's talk and Doug, lives change. You know, I really believe that it's God working through us, and it's an amazing thing to watch, and I wouldn't take a minute for it. And if you didn't hear Beverly's talk, it was really good. Know what I mean, baby? But it was a wonderful talk. And we had a good time. Now, if you wondered what all that was about on the tape, you should have been here. Then you would have known. But I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be sober. I want to tell you three things: that I love God, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love being sober, and I don't apologize for any of the three anymore. There was a long time when I felt I had to apologize, and for loving God and even being happy in AA, you know. A lot of us like to... There's a lot of people who go through life, get into a rut and come out of us, and there's some of us alcoholics get into a rut and start decorating that bad boy, you know. Hanging pictures and, you know. And I liked that for a while, right up until it got a little too uncomfortable, and then I changed it. And by God's grace, Ron mentioned my height. It seems to be obvious. I used to drink thinking I had to do things to get attention. Now all I have to do is walk into a room. It's amazing. And it's always the same size person asking the same two questions. First question is,
how tall are you?
6'10".
Do you play basketball?
No. How tall are you?
5'7".
Do you play miniature golf? They made up the rules. I didn't. I could do that, see? And I had the good pleasure to come to know Wilt Chamberlain pretty well, and that "How's the weather up there?" It was always funny. Somebody'd come up to Wilt and say, "How's the weather up there?" And he'd go, "Raining." Of course, I'm on a higher level now, so when they say, "How's the weather up there?" I have to say, "Heavenly, thank you." I just... But I love being sober, and I love the laughter, and a lot of healing took place last night with Doug's talk, and I thank you for that, because that is the music, the magic and the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you've been here even for a while and haven't heard it, stay tuned to this station, because your antennae will eventually get reception. Till then, bring the body, you know, and you'll get to hear the magic and the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to my first AA meeting when I was 10 years old. My older brother brought me. He's 44 years sober. He's so dry we don't let people smoke around him anymore. And I remember going to that A&A meeting, and there was some old guy up here about 30, you know.
Saying, "My name's Fred, and I'm an alcoholic." And I thought, good for you, Fred, you know.
If I ever get old and burn out, I may be here too. I didn't know I was a prophet at that point. It just took a few years. And the reason I share that with you is Beverly shared it so eloquently last night. There's people in this room right now that have loved ones out there doing it, you know, practicing this disease. And when I went to that meeting at 10 years old, and the meetings that I went to afterwards, not for me, but to hang around with my brother, he dragged me around. Every time I got in trouble, I didn't think, you know, I need 12 golden steps to walk up and find God. I didn't think I need to go to A&A. My problem was the same as yours. Even at a very young age, it was memories of what might have been, if onlys. And why do I have to be me? And that hole in my gut with the wind blowing through, and I just ached, and I instinctively knew that I was wrong, and I didn't even know why. Those are my earliest memories. I come from a very elite group of people called white trash, and there's certain things expected when you're white trash. You got to act a certain way and have cars broken down in your yard and go to jail a lot. And we managed to do that. And, well, you know, certain things are expected. And everybody has their burden. And I joke about it now, but that used to kill me. That used to just kill me. I couldn't figure out why the kind of clothes I wore bothered you and why you had to make fun of me. And, you know, those were the days when you wore hand-me-downs. And I had big brothers right up until I outgrew them. It was just that much too late, so they had to wear my hand-me-downs. I always regretted that. But I'd wear hand-me-downs, and I'd go to school, and people would say mean things to me. And I thought, why? What did I ever do to you? You know, I don't even know you. And I used to cry at the drop of a hat. And in my neighborhood, you changed that real quickly. And I started lying real early on. You know what I started saying? I don't care. I don't care. I work with a lot of young people when they look at me right in the eye and say, I don't care, I just love them more. Because you know what? They can't afford to. I understand that. I don't know when I started drinking. It was very early. I know that alcohol for me did something that nothing else did, and that made this world a survivable place. It made the madness in my head and my stomach calm for just a while. One of the things I heard when I came to AA, you keep drinking, you're going to die, and I thought, cool, when? And they used to say, we're going to restore your life, and I'd say, pass. No thanks. What I didn't hear is it's a new life when we come here. The old is gone away as soon as we let it go away. But I didn't know that. At the age of 13, I was arrested by the Iowa Highway Patrol for possession of a sawed-off shotgun. I wasn't using it to entertain anybody. I'd already got to the point you weren't going to hurt me anymore. If anybody was going to do the hurting, it was going to do me doing it to you, and I was going to laugh about it. Tickles me, or saddens me, really, when I hear people say, my goodness, what is it with these children taking guns to school? This happened 40 years ago that I know about. Just must be in the good people's neighborhood now that they're concerned. Because there's still people dying in those neighborhoods every day, and it don't even make the press. And I didn't like this world, and I didn't like anything in it, but I knew I was stuck in it. And so I did the best I could with what I had. And I don't know about you, but I developed a trait very young that I don't know where I got it, but I carried it a long time into sobriety. And that is, I could walk into a room of 300 people, 299 could turn around and say, Ed, you're the best, man, we love you. And one, just one, could say, jerk. And guess who I focused on? Not only did I focus on that one, but my sickness, it got to the point of where the 299 didn't even exist anymore. It was just the ones. The ones that said I was white trash, that I'd never be anything. That people like you can't do things like this. That you're worthless, that you're going to end up dead and in prison, or in prison just like your brother. Why are you even breathing? I always heard them, and I didn't hear the 299. Oh, I heard them, but I never gave them any credibility. The teachers that used to say to me, you know, you have so much potential. Yeah, right. You just want me to make class every now and then. Or the ones that say, you're so talented, you're gifted, you're bright. Yeah, right. How many here were potential to death? I was potential to death, and I'm here to tell you something. They were right and you've been wrong. Time to accept it. And that's one of the gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I'm concerned. We get to put away the nonsense of our own negative worthlessness and start to believe the world around us. January 5th of 1971, I got sober. I really didn't mean to. It wasn't in my Palm Pilot. I didn't plan on it. It was 18 below zero, and I was laying in the middle of the street, 6th and LeClaire in Davenport, Iowa. And we'd just been in a car accident, but that wasn't unusual anyway. I did that on a regular basis. And I was laying in the middle of the street pretending like I was knocked out. I'm not quite sure why. It seemed like a good idea at the time. And the police came up and they said, that's Mutum. Don't touch him. He's the scum of the earth. Don't even cover the little SOB. Or he didn't say little. I'm sorry. They said, don't even cover the SOB. Let him freeze to death. And you see, I'm a cop fighter. I became a cop fighter at a very early age. If I saw a badge, I swung. You know, if you were a crossing guard, I'd take you out. You know, show me a little badge. And they said that night, and I laid there. And I had no more fight. I agreed. For some reason, it was clear to me that night that I was there as the direct result of my best judgment. The finest ideas I could come up with put me right there. And one thing became clear to me, and only one thing, that I cannot drink or use no matter what. And I didn't know how to do that. And they ran me to the hospital because I did have a head injury, and rolled me by a nurse, and some nurse said, "Do you want me to call AA?" And I went, "Might as well." Now, us old timers want to know why you new people can't be sincere like we were in the old days. You know? That was it. Might as well. And I remember there was some guy came in to make a 12-step call on me. His name was Hap, short for happy. And you're hungover and you got a headache. And some guy named Happy comes in all smiling, all teeth. "Hi, Ed, my name's Hap." I thought, get out of my room. Jeez. And he said, "We don't drink and we don't use, one day at a time." And I don't know why I got honest, but I got honest with him. I said, "You don't get it. I can't make it a day without something to ease this pain." And he said, "Well, all we have to do in AA is try." And that's the only thing I've done consistently from that day to this, is try to do my best with the full knowledge that I cannot drink or use. And I started going to A&A meetings. And they were nice, and I started listening, and then they started talking about honesty, and I thought, well, I'll cut down on the stealing, just do enough to make ends meet, you know, nothing fancy. And they educated me that no, that wasn't correct. But then they talked about an honesty. Doug touched on it a little bit last night, and it was a self-honesty. And, you know, I'd lie when the truth had served me better. I had no idea of the truth. So every time you know, all these people who spend all this time trying to figure out how they feel, it's going to change by tomorrow anyway. You know? And how I felt was all a lie. So what was the truth? That's why sponsorship is necessary, as far as I'm concerned. A guide to help get me honest. Now, I didn't have that the first couple of years sober. I didn't want to get personally involved with anybody. And I say that kind of cocky now, but the truth is I didn't think I was worth bothering anybody that much. I didn't think I was worth bothering and taking up their time because they had things to do. And I remember Father Tom was in meetings. And Father Tom, well, let me go back a minute. You remember my 299-to-1 theory? Carried into church, too. I can remember Mom used to drag us to church, good old Lutheran church, and that pastor would sit up there and he'd have those thin blue lips and he'd say, "You're going to burn in hell, young man. That's what you're going to do." And I thought, how's he know? I only been here an hour. But he always seemed to pick me out. And then there was this guy up front who was, and so blue-lipped and so calm, and so he was having a lot more fun in the bar last night. And I don't know who that lady was last night, but she was having a lot more fun too. And that was my one out of the 299. You know, I never give any credibility to the 300 people that were sitting behind him, just the one that would fit my case. The negative image that would fit my case. And they used to say in church, "God is responsible for everything. Every hair on your head." Well, he's kind of missed me, hadn't he? Every bird, you know, and I just get so mad because here's why. I'd go home and turn on the light in the middle of the night to get a drink of water and a million roaches would run everywhere. And I'd think, God is responsible for everything. Dad had come home, drank up the check again. He and Mom would fight and the police would come and take away Dad, and I'd say, God is responsible for everything. And I'd have to fight my way to and from school because of the stupid remarks people would make to me, and I'd say, God is responsible for everything. After a while, it was pretty obvious that God didn't like me much, so I won't like him. We fast forward to AA. I'm sober about 6 months. At about 6 months, you get honesty. At about 8 months, you get a little tact to go with it. I'd suggest you wait for the 8 months. Just my 2 cents. Father Tom came up and said, "Ed, why don't you come back to church?" And I said, "I'll tell you why I don't go back to church. It's full of thieves, hypocrites, and liars." And I felt good about it. And he looked at me and said, "Why don't you come? One more won't hurt." I punished him. I didn't talk to him for months, you know. If you're new or if you're old and somebody says something really makes you mad, it's the truth. Just sign it, you know. It's the truth. Co-sign it. You're done. Put a fork in you, you know. It's the truth. And I saw Tom a few weeks ago, and I love him. He makes my heart beat. You know, a lot of times in AA, we say it doesn't count what you say to somebody. I'll do a little description. When I got sober, I was 6'11 then, shortened up over the last 30 years. Had shoulder-length hair, dark glasses. You weren't going to see me, but I was going to see you. Tie-dyed shirt, swastika around my neck, motorcycle chain around my waist, leather boots, and a sneer. And I'd walk into meetings. I remember walking into one meeting one time, and some guy said, "Ed, how do you feel?" I said, "Fine, man." He said, "Well, you tell your face, it don't know." And I got sober just a short time before treatment centers came in, and we won't even go into that. I'm grateful they're there for those who have got sober through them. I'll leave it at that. And I shook it out, you know. I got sober in a time when we'd give you paraldehyde and we'd set up with you, and you might die and you might not. And we went to meetings with tongue depressors in our pockets with adhesive tape around it just in case somebody went into convulsions, so we could walk it out with them. And I started going to meetings and I started listening. And I was wired for sound. And there was two things I hated: living things and dead things. Everything else was all right. And there was two rules. You didn't come up behind me and you didn't touch me. You know, we were talking about it. The freedom to sit with your back to an open room. I still rejoice in that one every day. And there was an old guy named Harry Stevens. Harry's passed away. Harry was about this tall and about as big around as he was tall. And Harry poured coffee at the meetings. And Harry would come up behind me and he'd put his hand right here and he'd pour coffee. Now, I don't know why, but for a minute, everything was okay. For a minute, all the voices stopped, the craziness stopped, and I could breathe deeply. And Harry'd pour that coffee, and then he'd walk away, and it'd all come back. And I'd drink that coffee just as quick as I could. So Harry'd come back and pour me a cup of coffee. Big old tough me. Big old crazy Ed. The human touch I'd longed for so long out of loving and care, and it healed me. My only regret is I never told Harry, "Harry, you saved my life." He thought he was just pouring me a cup of coffee. He was healing me. There's a guy named Jimmy Ryan out in Malibu in California for years. And Jimmy was from Texas, and he'd talk like this. You remember Jimmy? Jimmy was a salesman. He'd talk like this, and he'd rub his hands, and he'd say, "You know, one time somebody told me, I asked some psychologist why I rubbed my hands like this. He told me I smacked him right in the mouth." And Jimmy was just great. And I met Jimmy at a time when I was going through a lot of very severe depression. And I worked through that through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that offends some people. Pray for me. But that's what happened. I was in one of those dark times, and it happened a couple times, and I don't know if Jimmy said it to everybody or not, but it's really not important. I walked into 26th and Broadway, and I was thinking about going back to the house and just turning on the gas and going to sleep. No notes, no dramatics. It's just sober's too tough. I can't do it. And I'd walk into that place, and I'd say to Jimmy, "How are you, Jimmy?" And it was like the world stopped, and Jimmy just stopped, and it was like he took my face just like this. He didn't, but that's how it felt. And he said, "I'm much better for seeing you, my friend. I'm much better for seeing you." And he saved my life that day. I thought, if a nice guy like Jimmy likes me, and if I make him feel better, maybe I'm worth it. Maybe I'm worth saving. And I stayed sober another day. You know, humor and glib remarks are cute, and I'm a master at it, and I've slipped a couple times this weekend on it because it used to be a defense of mine for a long time, and I hope I've made the amends to the people I needed to, because I made some amends. It's an old habit that sometimes creeps up, and I really want to be careful about what I say to individuals about what I think's funny. You know, we were having a conversation at breakfast with Beverly, and I made an offhanded joke, and it was something that was very serious to her, and I said, "I'm sorry, please tell me what you really think," and she did, and I appreciated that. Because it's not about insulting people here. It's not about putting people down. It's not about one-upsmanship. It's about love and service. And if it gets to be about anything else than that, it's not Alcoholics Anonymous, in my opinion. I started going to meetings. Now, I told you my problem with God, and they told me if you're going to stay sober, you got to have a relationship with God. And I thought, that's annoying, you know. Because I used to say I was an atheist. I used to say I was an agnostic. And a few years ago, I realized I was neither. I believed in God, and everything I believed, I hated and was angry about. That's a big difference. But I never knew that till a few years ago. Everything I believed, I hated. And that had to change. And they said, you have to have a higher power to stay sober. And I thought for a minute, I thought, well, okay, I'm going to have a higher power that's kind and loving and forgiving. How do you like that? Didn't seem to bother him at all, actually. And I thought I was original. Don't we all? Terminally unique. And they said, you had to pray. And I said, yeah, and how you do that? They had, please in the morning, thank you at night. Yeah, okay, I'll do that. But there were some old-timers around in AA that talked about God. And to this day, the language of the heart comes right out of the eyes. They're the mirror of the soul, and I've always believed that and always have. And these old-timers would talk about God, and I knew they were telling the truth. I don't know that I bought it, but I knew they did, and it was so believable. And I made a major mistake. I started professing a faith I didn't have. I became so spiritual, I was of no earthly good. I would go to meetings and take it so easy, you'd have to remind me to breathe, you know? Now, that may not be a bad situation, but if you're like me, there will be a time in your life that the big book talks about that your reliance on God is the only thing between you and that first drink or something very bad. And you better have a faith you can rely on. I was sober a little over a year, and Dad asked me over for dinner, which might not be unusual for you guys, but it was very unusual for me. Dad had really tried to help on his drinking and had cut way down, and he asked me over for dinner, and man, I knew what happened. When I got called for dinner, I was in trouble. I'd been out of the house since I was 13, you know, and rightfully so. But every time I'd go over there, if he'd call, I knew I was in trouble for something. And I'd hung around you people, and you taught me to bring new attitudes into old situations. Excuse me. Suit up and show up is what they say. And so I did. I went over there with a smile on my face and went to dinner. And we got about halfway through dinner. And Dad said, boy, and I thought, here it comes. And he said, I just want to tell you, I'm proud of you. Now, I need to tell you something. As I walked in that door, if you would have hooked up a lie detector, and if you would have asked me if I cared about what he thought about me, I would have said no, and it would have said true. You see, AA's promises had already come. That was beyond my wildest dreams, and it was already happening. My father looked at me and said, I'm proud of you, son. I'd never heard it before, and for good reason. And it was one of the best nights of my life. I mean, I think I popped a button or two on my shirt, you know. It was just cool. And I left and I went to a meeting, and after the meeting I went to my sister-in-law's house, and I got a call from my mother, who was crying and hysterical, and said, Ed, come home quick. And I said, what's wrong? She said, I don't know. Dad went across the street to get him a quart of beer and me a bottle of pop, and now they're carrying bodies out, and there's police everywhere. Please come home. And she's crying. And I had that pseudo-spirituality of, everything's good now. God likes me. Nothing bad could be happening. And it was one of those ice storms. You get them up here where a quarter-inch ice over everything, and it's just horrible to drive. And that was the kind of night. It took me forever to get across town. I pulled up to that bar that I'd spent many nights drinking in, and there were more policemen there than I'd ever seen before or since. And you know, that first year sober, I was working through the courts to help people who had drinking problems. We weren't counselors then. We were just people trying to help. And those policemen knew I'd been sober, and it's funny how they'd shaped up in that year. You know? And I walked into that bar, and one of the officers there said, Ed, what are you doing here? And I said, my dad was in here. He said, oh, my God. And I said, why? What's going on? He said, we don't know, Ed. All we know is somebody came in and opened fire and shot everybody. And I looked down the bar at that pool of blood with my father's glasses in it. You'd think after 30 years it would go away. And I said, where'd they take the bodies? And he said, everybody's up at the hospital. Some are alive, some are dead. And you can go up there. And I went up there to the hospital, and there was an officer there that hadn't forgiven my past. And he said, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm here to see if my dad is up here. He was in the Shamrock, and he was very vulgar and very kind of foul and rude and told me to leave. He had identified everybody. And an AA miracle happened. I looked at him, and I said, okay. Because the golden rule is, don't ever talk to me that way. Don't ever harm anyone in my family. If it wasn't for you folks, I would be in jail for murder. I said, okay, and I went home and I called the one guy I would have believed I'd never called in a million years. And he was the lieutenant on the narco division who'd been watching me for the last 5 years. He'd put me in the back of his car at one point and said, if I see you leaving the scene of the crime or think I see you leaving the scene of the crime, I'm going to shoot to kill and not stop. And I said, everything's fair in love and war, chump. I mean, let's face it, he shoots me, I'm something. I'm a hero. I might be something before I die. That's the guy I called. He said, Ed, what do you need? And I said, Dad was in that Shamrock. And he said, oh, my God, Eddie, hold on. Because, you know, he knew I was sober, too. I had a lot of company when I got sober. The bad guys kept watching me to figure out what I was up to, and the good guys figured I was up to something. So I had a lot of company wherever I went. But he knew I was sober, and he fed me details. And the only thing we could come up with is that maybe he was shot and wandered outside, or they took him hostage. So we formed a search party, and we searched the streets for 8 hours. You know, I'd hoped none of you would ever know that feeling, and that then September 11th happened, and you all got a taste of that feeling of how could it happen? Why would it happen? Who could ever do such a thing? And why, even though you've been around it, it still just rips your heart out. And after 8 hours, the policeman from up at the hospital said, well, Ed, anybody could have made a mistake. Your old man's up here. You want to come up and identify him? And I said, okay. And I went up and I walked into that morgue, and I saw my father laying on that metal table with that bullet hole in his face as some nice Oriental doctor was trying to tell me how it entered the brain and exploded, and I asked him to leave me alone. And I reached for that faith I'd been professing and came up with absolutely nothing, because it was all your words and all your experience and none of my work. You see, if we're going to do these steps, it's got to come from the inside out. And my understanding of this program is exactly what it says in the book, that it's designed for me to develop a relationship with God or a higher power or God greater than me that solved my problem. And I hadn't done that. I'd always took the easier way, you know. I'd pick up a few cliches. But I had enough there that I was able to... First, I got mad. That old God that I'd been taught about that knows everything, they also told me that anything you do bad, God will punish you or one of your relatives. And I cried thinking, I killed my dad. I'm just trying to get sober. I killed my dad. And he's responsible for everything, and it just made me sad. And I left there, and I had a reason to review that situation a lot the last few years, and I realized everywhere I went there was an AA member right here, or right here, never right here. Right here, right here. Coincidence, I guess. And they'd give me a little thumbs up and wink. And what they were telling me is, man, you need anything, we got you. You see, that's how my God is. He's with me everywhere. And all I got to do is ask, and he'll help. But he needs me to ask. He respects our free will. And that's what changed, what gave me one of the keys to the kingdom. I went to the funeral. And a priest gave my father's funeral, because 6 months, Dad never set foot in a church. But 6 months before he died, he was in the hospital. And to everyone's amazement, he called spiritual care and asked for someone to come and baptize him. And Father Grubb did that. So Father Grubb did his funeral. And at the funeral, Father Grubb did something that helped change my life. He said, you know, a lot of people would say Clifford's death is God's will. He said, I don't believe that for a minute. And I sat right up in the pew. He said, God created human beings, gave them a free will. They chose to do this act, and now it's God's will. It's like the weight of the world fell off my shoulders. Because you see, I knew there wasn't a God, because if there's a God, why are there starving children everywhere? It's real simple. We're not feeding them. Don't blame God anymore. There's more than enough food. If there's a God, why is cancer so rampant? Real simple. We pollute everything we touch. Don't blame God anymore. You see, I've come to believe that if it isn't good, it isn't God. And I can back that up with Scripture. And that's amazing. I went to that murder trial they called me to identify, and there was the one guy sitting there, and he had his little attitude going. And I thought, you know, you give me 5 minutes in the room with this guy, we don't need a trial. And bring his four buddies in, too. We'll make this short business. But you'd spoiled me. I'd hung around you too long. You told me that everywhere I go, I'm an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this was a big media trial. It's still in Iowa's history its most heinous crime. And please God, it'll always stay that way. No more, please. And that's what I went there. I went there and I conducted myself as a gentle person. And I answered the man's questions and I sat down. And I didn't go over the rail after the guy. And I didn't flip him off. And I didn't do any of the things my head was telling me to. And I left. And they convicted all five of them. And I thought, well, that's that. About that time, God talked to me. And unlike Beverly, God talks to me all the time. I don't know. But I don't mind it. There was a long time when I didn't listen. I could sure listen to my lower power. I couldn't listen much to my higher power. And that's what the steps are about, to help you figure out which is which, in my opinion. And I was a worshiper of the lower power in every sense of the word. And God talked to me one day and said, Ed, go out to California. Get into show business. Well, you don't argue with God. And I looked at my resume. It made perfect sense. So I jumped in my car and went to where all stars get their start, Anaheim, California. I got a job at Disneyland. I was goofy. 2.5 years sober, not reading the big book anymore, no sponsor really. Yeah, I was goofy. And I didn't actually start that job. I went up to a meeting in West L.A. where people were happy and doing things and moving each other in service work. And I mean, they weren't talking it, they were doing it. It was just amazing, and there was an enthusiasm in the room. And a lot of times I hear people say, oh, you're too enthusiastic. I hear that. Enthusiastic comes from the Greek word entho. When you break it all down, it's the God from within. So if anybody tells you you're enthusiastic about Alcoholics Anonymous, tell them thank you, you know? But I was impressed by this group because they were talking about doing things. I was used to going to meetings, and Fred would stand up once a year, and you'd flip him a chip, and he'd sit back down. You know, hey, Fred, what's next? And these people were doing things, and that is wonderful, AA, if that's comfortable for you. I don't put that down. But this ignited a fire in me that I didn't know existed. It was about surviving and living and being happy about it. And I went up there the next week, and I said, there was this guy directing people, and I thought he was some sort of big deal. So I said, excuse me, would you be my sponsor? He said, no. And I said, why not? He said, anybody I sponsor has to look up to me. I thought, oh, good, tall jokes, that's what we really need. And he came up a few minutes later and he said, my name's Clancy. He said, if you agree to do a few things, I'll sponsor you. And you know, I travel around a lot and I hear a lot of garbage about that man. And I need to tell you, if I'd heard that garbage, you would have killed me, because I would have believed you. You would have killed me, because I would have believed you. I try not to put down individuals or groups in Alcoholics Anonymous to preserve my little ego, because it may kill somebody that I'm talking to. I may not like what they do at all, but that's up to you. That's between you and your God and your sponsor if you got one. It isn't up to me to smash it down because I'm not bright enough to take time to learn what it's about. And so I try to make it my business not to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's vicious and it's nasty. And I'll tell you something. You're sitting around talking with somebody who's gossiping, you're next. Better make a new friend now, because you're next. It's just the truth. And Clancy told me that I had to work these steps rather than talk about them. That I had to do my very best all the time, and I didn't like that because I'm kind of a half measures guy. I like to do what it takes to get along and not a whole lot more. Unfortunately, my life was on the line, so I had to do it because thoughts were creeping in of suicide. I remember he told me, they don't lock you up for how you think, they lock you up for how you act. Think anything you want, watch how you act. And Clancy pulled a lot of strings. He's a very powerful guy, you know, and pulled a lot of strings in Los Angeles. And I got a job as a bellhop from 11 to 7 at the Royal Inn at Santa Monica Boulevard, down on Ocean Drive or whatever it is. And they gave me this great little blue outfit, this coat that fit really good, and a little blue hat. And I'd sit there from 11 to 7, 3 years sober, going, man, I'm a rocket to stardom, you know. And little old ladies would come in and drop their bag on my foot. Pick up that bag, boy. And I'd think, which one? You or it? But I wouldn't say that. I'd say, yes, ma'am. And I'd take that bag and I'd go upstairs and I'd open it up and I'd go to the door and wait for my tip. And they'd close the door and like to break my fingers. And I'm thinking, I'm going to kick in the door, grab this old broad, throw her out the window and watch her splatter. But what I did is say, thank you, and I went downstairs. Now, that may not mean much to you, but I'll tell you what it did for me. It's called freedom from the bondage of self. You see, if I thought it, I thought it was the truth. If I felt it, I thought I had to do it. I didn't know that that's part of our discipline in Alcoholics Anonymous. The mental, the physical, the spiritual, the discipline, that we could do that. That may sound strange to you, but I didn't know that. And that was the best third step I could do, is just forget what I was thinking. And then I remember one time, Chuck C. and was a person I knew well, and God, he taught me so much, and I still learn from what he taught me. And I went to him one time, and I said, Chuck, how do you pray? And he said, your every thought's a prayer. And I went, uh-oh. I'm in big trouble in River City, you know. And then I thought, well, if it's crap, why am I thinking it? Why don't I try to make my every thought a prayer? Why not? And I'll tell you what, I've been doing it from then till now. I'm better at it than I've ever been. Got a long ways to go. But why not? You know, it's back to those 299s or the ones. What are we going to choose? The toughest thing I believe we have to fight in sobriety is good times, success, the unfamiliar called happy, joyous, and free. I hear it all the time.
Well, I've been coming around 25 years, still got every character defect.
Might try the steps, just a suggestion, you know.
I've been around 30 years, I've never taken a fifth step.
I can tell, thank you very much, you know. And if that's the kind of sobriety you want, excellent. But I needed something to grant me some peace inside. I remember the first time I experienced peace. I called my sponsor up. And I said, Clance, something's going on. I said, well, Ed, what's going on? He said, how's work? I said, fine. And I was married at the time. He said, how's your wife? I said, oh, good, everything's good. He said, and financially? Oh, great, great. He said, Ed, nothing's wrong. I'm like, oh. I wasn't used to that. I was used to putting in the craziness. I was used to the turmoil. This program demands that we change from the inside out. Clancy told me to suit up and show up no matter what. I went to talk in this meeting in Pasadena, California. And it was funny because I was broke. I was living on Venice Beach and I was flat broke. And I was going to speak at this meeting and I thought, ooh, Pasadena, California, wealthy area, I might get a job, you know. And I caught myself running that little con and I dropped to my knees to pray to the God I'd started all over with, and my first honest prayer ever was, God, I don't know if you're there or not, man, I sure hope so. And that's what I urge you to do with your God. Be honest with where you're at, not where you think you should be or your parents told you, or where are you with your God? And I dropped to my knees and I said the same prayer I said before I came out here this morning. I said, Father, save me from my own nonsense, only I didn't use the word nonsense then. So let me share the miracle you've performed in my life through Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want absolutely nothing from these people. Absolutely nothing. And I went and talked, and I finished that talk, and a guy came up to me afterwards and said, this makes no sense to me, but I want to offer you a job. I said, it makes perfect sense to me. He said, have you ever been in show business management? I said, no. He said, have you ever been in Taiwan? I said, no. He said, be in my office Monday morning. Monday morning, I went to his office. That was Saturday. Monday morning, I went to his office in Century City. Thursday afternoon, I was on China Airlines, lifting out of LAX, going to Taipei, Taiwan. I was soon to be the new vice president of America on Ice. I had a cast of 63. I was going over to Taiwan to build the ice rink and the costumes, flying back and forth with Bill Campbell from Las Vegas to design those costumes. How was your week? Now, you know why I share that story? I had put down my one. There would have been a time when I wouldn't even have shown up for the interview. You see, I'm white trash. People like me don't do things like that. You're going to be dead by the time you're 21. It was all gone. I showed up for the interview. And they asked me about the job, and they said, how do you feel? I said, scares the heck out of me. And they said, you're hired. And I had a strange look, and they said, the reason you're hired is everybody's telling me it's a snap. He said, I've been in this business 25 years. A guy named Shelley Kasten. Been in this business 25 years. He says, scares me to death. I don't want some cocky young punk going over there thinking it's all okay. And do you know why God had me do that? To show me qualities and gifts that I would have never believed I had unless he'd let me see them. I would have called my sponsor and whined, not got it done. I would have hung out with my folks group and whined, never got it done. I'm 10,000 miles away from anybody. It's just me and God and a telephone, thank God. I remember I was there shortly, and I found out I was funded by the Taiwanese mafia. And even though we were guests of the educational department, and they didn't want to pay me my money, and you had given me something called integrity, and I was going to preserve it. And by God, they were going to pay me my money because I could pay my cash. And so I kept getting my money. They had tricks not to pay me, and I had tricks for them to pay me. like right in the middle of the show, stopping and having the announcer say, the promoters won't pay us. And when you tell that to 9,000 Taiwanese, they get upset. So I'd end up with my money every night. But they had death threat on me, and I had bodyguards that came up to here. I felt real safe now. I always like to tell when I got off the plate in Taiwan, everybody's this tall, and they're looking at me, and I'm looking at them. And I knew it was just a matter of time before they pulled that rope out and tied me down, you know. Anyway, that was a wonderful experience, and traumatic and wonderful all at the same time. I don't have time to tell you about it. But I'll tell you this. I was in Kaohsiung, and a guy walked by me and said, you know, you'd be an excellent manager for the Harlem Globetrotters. And I went, yeah, right. Good. And I went back to Los Angeles, and I was back 3 months, and the Harlem Globetrotters called me up and said, Mr. Mutum, we've heard a lot of wonderful things about you. Can you come and talk to us about being a manager? And I suited up, and I showed up. I left my wands. And I went to that interview, and after a short 8-hour interview where I was rigorously honest, I found myself manager of the Harlem Globetrotters. Flying to New York City, having every major credit card in the world, 10,000 cash, and I get on the bus, and there's Metal Arc Lemon and Curly Neal, and I'm in charge. Dog! Right on. I used to think, does it get much better than that? And the answer is, yep. Yep. I traveled all over the world. You see, I remember when I was a kid, I used to be on 6th and LeClaire, and I used to play hard, and I'd get dirt rings all up in my neck, and my hair would be sticking straight up, and I'd have those wraparound clothes, and I used to dream about traveling all over the world and meeting famous people. I told that to one of my friends once, and they said, jerk, what's wrong with you, man? When I came to AA, you dared me to reclaim my dreams, and I'm going to challenge you, I don't care how old you are, to reclaim your dreams. My personal feeling is that's God's gift to you. Quit looking for it. He already gave it to you. Have guts enough to walk toward it. And I remembered that when I got on that bus with the Harlem Globetrotters. You see, you've never misled me here. I met the daughter of the Turkish ambassador. She was Muslim, wealthy, absolutely beautiful. I thought, our backgrounds are a lot alike. I didn't say all sanity had returned, but we got married, and we were married for 10 years, and we should have never been married. We have 3 wonderful children, and they're not a mistake, but, you know, I hear people say all the time, we shouldn't have gotten married. That's all there is to it. And you hear in AA a lot about, you know, oh, I was sober this, and I was sober in all the programs, and then I met him, and then I met her, and, you know, I don't need a him or her anymore. I got you, and I got God, and I'm quite happy with that. And if a her comes along someday, cool. May have already come along, I don't know. But in the meanwhile, that isn't the cause of my happiness or my misery. God is. And I need to remember that. 18 years sober, I made some decisions based on self that cost me everything I owned, and they came and repossessed the Mercedes and evicted me out of my Burbank apartment. And I thought, well, this isn't in the book. But it is. It is. It talks about losing priorities, you know. Talks about putting other things before your sobriety. And without even knowing it, what I was and who I was became my God. And I didn't even know it, honestly. I didn't do that intentionally. And it all got taken away. And in 1988, I went back to East 6th Street and started fresh. Didn't drink. There's no reason to drink. You know, I hear people say, gee, so since I've been sober, my father was murdered. Mother died of cancer. Brother-in-law committed suicide. Another brother-in-law killed in a car wreck. Another brother-in-law put a gun to his head, was a vegetable for 2 years. Been married, divorced, lost everything I owned. No reason to drink. No reason to drink. This program works. It isn't an accident. It isn't just when you're doing good times. It's when you're in the worst of times. It's when your heart's so broken and you can't think you can go another step, that it's just another step that you need to go. Alcoholics Anonymous works in all conditions. And I did a few things, and one day I decided to quit smoking, and the doctor told me to start running and exercising, so I started getting in shape, got the right shoes, and stretched, and went out and broke my leg. If you're 330 pounds, don't jog. Just a little. Hope with you. But while I'm sitting there, God talks to me again. And I'm sitting in my house really kind of having a pleasant day. You know, things had picked up. I got a little apartment house, and I'm sitting there, and things are starting to get caught up on bills and child support and all that stuff that, God, you hate to get behind, but sometimes you do. And God talked to me, and he was real clear. He said, Ed, what about education? And I went, what? I did what any alcoholic could do. I went, la, 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 la. And he didn't care. He called right back. Ed, what about education? Well, I knew what to do then, you know. You get sober a while, you get that kind of message, you go do it. And I got my crutches and I waddled over to the university there and I said, I need to go to school. And they said, how many credits do you have? I said, I have bad credits. Why? What's that got to do with it? And they laughed at me like you did, but then I shared with them a great gift that I please God that I'll never forget. And I've used it many times this weekend. I was able to say, you know, I don't know anything about going to school. I'm not sure if I'm smart enough to pass a class, but I do know I'd like to try. Would you help me? And they loved me all the way through school. You know, after you get to living with the 299s, you realize it's not just in AA. They're all over the world, especially when you start looking for them. And I started going to college, and I went to college full-time, and I worked full-time, and I didn't miss one AA commitment. I'm not one of those that you can come up to and say, gee, I don't know if I have the time. I'll tell you something. God wants you to do it. He'll give you a 36-hour day. He's done it to me many times. I've accomplished far more than I ever dreamed possible. And I started going to school, and then I went on a Christian retreat. And on that Christian retreat, I had a spiritual awakening, a mountaintop experience that changed me from this moment, from that moment to this. And it gave me a peace and a sense of a God that hasn't left me. And it changed my heart and it changed my mind. And God said, I need you as a minister. And I said, okay. And I left that retreat, and within 3 weeks I was preaching at a church. And went to the United Methodist Church and said, what do we got to do here? And they said, you got to finish your BA and then you got to get your little 96-hour Master's of Divinity degree. And I said, okay. And I said, I only have one request, that you let me speak in Alcoholics Anonymous once a month, because if it wasn't for them, you would have never got me. And they said, fine. And I started on into the ministry, and I went through seminary, and I took every single hour. I didn't experientialize on any. I didn't clep on any. Could have done a lot, but you know what? I wanted the degrees to be mine. And I went there, and I had church in a small community of 200 people, and my friend Harold, I got called, and Harold had stomach cancer, radical stomach cancer. Harold was one of the better men I've ever known. He was an Iowa farmer in a small community that if anybody needed anything, it got taken care of quietly. You'd never know Harold did it. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful, hard-working man. And they called me and said he'd just got this diagnosis. Would I come down? And I went down and walked into his house. And I'm doing on-the-job training with this minister thing, you know. And I'm thinking, well, you're probably supposed to pray, but I don't feel like praying. So I said, talk to Harold. And we're sitting there talking. I noticed Harold kept looking out his window. And Harold had this huge lawn on his farm. And he loved it. He always kept it so well trimmed. And I realized that the lawn was getting pretty long. And I said, Harold, can I mow your lawn for you? And he said, would you do that, Pastor Ed? And I said, I'd love to. And for 3.5 months, 4.5 hours every Monday, I mowed Harold's lawn. And then one day I mowed the lawn and I came in and I said, Harold, it's time to pray. And he said, okay, Pastor Ed. And then we said a good prayer. And I ended the prayer with, God bless you, Harold. And he said, no, God bless you, Pastor Ed. Because you see, Harold was a giver. He was always a giver. And he died 2 hours later. Now, where did I learn that? Right in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the best ministry in the world. One person ministering to another person, giving them the very best we got with no expectations. And I loved that. I had changed from a person that people asked me not to come around their houses. They'd cross the street when they see me coming, or they'd have a horrified look because I was a man of violence. To a person where people would say to me, Pastor Ed, time's short, and if there's any way possible, can you be here with me when I go? Jesus, I wouldn't take anything for that. I wouldn't trade that for anything. What an honor. And things went well, and I continued through school, and I became ordained, and I graduated with my Master's of Divinity, and then the church came to me and said, Ed, we need you to quit talking in AA. You're doing a wonderful job here at the church, and they love you, but they want you here every Sunday. And I had a church of 1,200 members, and I need to tell you, I love them as much as I love you. And it was a tough decision, yet it wasn't, because I knew where I'd gotten my gift. And so last June I had to leave that church. And all the plans I had laid out for making it survive have fallen through. And it's been a great struggle the last year, but I've loved it because it's brought me back closer to God and what's really important. About 3 years ago I was in the middle of a sermon on forgiveness. And I was giving them heaven because they'd had enough of hell, you know. Right in the middle of this sermon on forgiveness, I realized I'd never forgiven the guys who killed my father. Well, I'd forgiven them, but I hadn't done the most important part. Hadn't let them know. You know, I am a firm believer anymore that 8 and 9 has nothing to do with us. It's about fixing what we've done to them. And I stopped right in the middle of my sermon, and I made a covenant with them. I said, you know, I'm going to seek these guys out and let them know that they're forgiven. As God would have it, 2.5 weeks later, one of the guys' sentence was overturned. I didn't even know he had an appeal. I had done so well on forgetting that, I couldn't even remember their names. And as well as I could hate, believe me, that's a miracle that you've taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, we got to be careful when we have traumatic things happen, because if we're not careful, it'll become our identity rather than our experience. 2.5 weeks later, they overturned his sentence, and a lot of the press came to me and said, what do you think? And I'm well known and loved in my community by God's grace and how you taught me to behave. And I said, it's time to forgive and it's time to heal. And they said, he's been in there since he's 17 years old. He's been in there 27 years. He doesn't have a job. How's he going to survive? I said, he can come live with me if he wants. And people were taken back by that. And I'm still not quite sure why. You welcomed me into your homes. Can I give any less? If we're going to be an example, let's be an example. Talk's cheap. And that story literally went around the world. Oprah called me. 48 Hours called me. 2020 called me. It was on the front page of the LA Times one morning. Vince Yeo called me, or Vince Y called me. And it went all over the world. New York Times, London Times. And I couldn't tell them, well, it's step 8 and 9. If you come to some meetings, we could work it out with you. But they probably wouldn't have got it, you know. But what it did was it was a tremendous instrument of healing. And shortly after that, I was not allowed in the Iowa prisons because I was a security risk, because they were there. And all of a sudden, 2.5 weeks later, I get permission to go to the prison and see this man. And I'm walking down the prison that I swore I'd never go back into. My brother was there way too long, and I was always told I'd end up there. And I'm walking down, it's kind of gritty and the sound under my feet, and I'm just saying, God, let me be the best I can be. And I walked into that room and I saw a man there and stuck out my hand. And I said, Sherman, my name's Reverend Ed Mutum, and I'm here to tell you that I love you and I forgive you and God loves you. And if there's anything in my life that I can ever do to make your life better, let me do it. And I think he looked into my eyes and he saw an old timer. He didn't quite get it about this God thing, but he knew I was telling the truth. There was no games. And we talked for 2.5 hours. And we ended with a prayer where all the attorneys and the police and everybody was in tears. And a great healing took place. They had decided to retry him. And in the state of Iowa, if you are with someone in commission of a crime, a felony, you're guilty of the same felony if you know they possessed a gun. And that was Sherman. And that's for me. Tell them I'm busy. No, I've done that. I don't mean to embarrass you. Well, I did, but I'm sorry about it. But they had decided to retry him and sentence him again, and he'd spend the rest of his life in prison. And I went down and I talked to a district attorney who was a guy who I love. He's just a good, good man, and I asked him to give my friend mercy and let him plead second-degree murder. And he said, Ed, the guy's conning you. I said, he doesn't even know I'm here. Can't be a con. I'm here because I want to be here. And God, if there's any way to save a life out of this mess, I'd like to do it. And he listened. And he let him plead. And he pled second-degree murder, and there wasn't a dry eye in that courtroom when he pled the second degree and then turned around and made amends to everybody. Press was everywhere. And he said, I don't even know who I'm making amends to, but I know I was involved in a horrible, horrible thing. And he said, if there's anything I can ever do in my life to help you, let me do it. And if you need to hate me, I understand. And about 2 years ago, I got a call from correctional facility, and they said, Reverend Mutum, you're the only one we'll release him to. We're putting him on parole. You come up and get him. So I drove up to the penitentiary, and I got my friend Sherman, and I took him out, and we had a little breakfast, and I said, now we're going into breakfast, and this waitress is going to ask you a lot of harassing questions, like, how do you like your eggs? What kind of toast? Da-da-da-da-da. You know, you got to remember, 30 years of... And she came and asked questions. He said, it is kind of harassing, isn't it? And I said, yeah, it is. And then we walked out of the restaurant, and there was a beautiful pond right there on the left. And he said, Reverend Mutum, would you mind if I just stood here a minute and looked? And I said, stand all you want and look. You see, it had been 30 years at that point since he'd been able to stop and look at a pond, to open his own door, to order the food he'd like. And I believe for most of us in this room, it's seconds and inches that we could have traded places. The right circumstance, seconds and inches. And I was blessed to be able to go find out what size Sherman's clothes were. We took him to a store because he'd always worn President Eshoo since he was 17. And we got him clothes, and we got him a place, a halfway house to stay. And he was doing well, and then he got involved in a little relationship. And all of a sudden I got a call and said, Sherman's back in jail. And I said, oh God, my heart just broke a little bit. And they had to send him back to prison. And Sherman got his attitude. You know, he's been a lifer. It's tough out here. I remember one day I picked him up. He walked home, and I picked him up, and I pulled up beside him on a busy street in Davenport. And he got in the car, and tears were just running down his face. I said, Sherman, what's wrong? He said, Reverend Mutum, he said, all those cars coming up behind me, all that noise, it just terrifies me. And I was able to pull over and say, Sherman, it's okay. I love you, man. Those noises you'll get used to, and it'll be okay. And he said, I don't know that I can make it out here. And I said, I understand that. Well, they sent him back, and Sherman got a little attitude for a little while. And about 3 weeks ago, he called me and said, you know, I'm sorry about all I've done. I said, I understand that. And he said, I need a ride home. They're releasing me this Wednesday. And I said, I'll be there. And I said, don't worry, you'll stay with me. We'll get you going again. And I am going to ask you something this morning. I'm going to ask you to say prayers for Sherman. It's going to be a major miracle if he stays out of prison. But you see, you've made me familiar with major miracles.